Hello and welcome to Beyond the Mekong. My name is Luke Hunt and with me today is Michael Martin. Michael is a specialist in Asian affairs. He has a long history with the Congressional Research Service of the Library of Congress and is a specialist in China, Hong Kong, Vietnam, and for our purposes today, Myanmar. Michael, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Luke.
There's been a lot of change in Myanmar over the last 6 to 8 months, particularly with the success among the anti-regime forces in terms of their dry season offensive against the junta. What's your take on where we stand now as opposed to, say, October last year? How things changed?
Well, as you point out correctly, that in recent days, and interesting, continuing into the rainy season, you're seeing various different resistance forces launching offensive against military bases controlled by the junta and having, by and large, success. So the junta is being further pushed back into the core of the country by these forces in the northwest, the northeast, the east, and in the south.
There seems to be this consensus emerging that the junta, they can't win this one. Would you agree with that scenario?
Well, certainly the situation right now would look like it'd be extremely difficult for the junta to emerge victorious from this process. Mm. Although they have superiority in air power and heavy artillery and other military armaments, they're running short of soldiers and they're running short of small arms to continue the fight. And so they're being pushed further and further back towards Yangon, Rangoon, Mandalay, and Naypyidaw.
Right.
So it looks unlikely that they will emerge victorious, but that doesn't mean that it's clear what's going to happen if the resistance forces emerge victorious.
Is it possible for the EAOs, the ethnic armed organizations, the PDFs, the People Defense Forces, is it possible for them to take the Irrawaddy Basin, as in Yangon, Naypyidaw, and Mandalay? I mean, it'd be a hell of a fight.
Correct. I mean, that's the presumption that would be the sort of last stand for the military and they would consolidate their forces. And there's some indication that's what they're doing already. Whether or not the EAOs in particular and their affiliated PDFs would want to do that is another question altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of gets towards what are they fighting for?
Right.
Everybody knows what they're fighting against. There's unanimity among the opposition forces that everybody wants the military junta gone and pretty much unanimity that they want the military itself gone. So they know what they're fighting against. They're fighting against the military. They're fighting against the junta. But it's not clear that there's much agreement on what they're fighting for.
Right. And that's partly to do with the ethnic differences, the attitudes between not so much the PDFs and the EAOs, but certainly with the National Unity Government, the NUG, that likes to overlord, likes to... I don't want to sound dreadfully rude about the NUG, but they do tend to claim a position that they may not actually hold on the ground. There's a lot of EAOs and PDFs who are sort of a little bit mystified sometimes by their claims to have control over the areas within Myanmar that the EAOs have taken. Does that make sense?
I think you're characterizing it reasonably well. What you have is each of the EAOs, and I can quickly go around if you want.
Yeah, please.
Have in mind their own objectives, or at least as far as I know from communicating with them or people who are in touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the NUG, which has a very different political agenda and one that isn't agreed to by most of the major EAOs. So if I sweep from the west and around, mm-hmm, in a clockwise fashion, the Arakan army is fighting to take over Arakan or Rakhine State. And that's clearly their objective, is to create a highly autonomous Rakhine State or Arakan State, which may include part of Chin State and other neighboring divisions. But it's not clear after they've got that whether they would continue to pursue the military junta into the Irrawaddy River basin, or if they have to stop there and say, hey, you know, we have what we want, we're done. You go next to Qin state, there you have the various opposition forces among the Qin, and they're very clear in my direct communications with them that they're forming a Qin land that would also be highly autonomous. And they also may claim to part of Sagaing and Magway as part of Qin land. Mm-hmm. Moving around, the Kachin in recent months have been pushing back the junta forces. They want to form a highly autonomous Kachin state, and they have a government in place that's been around for a while, and they just keep extending it as they take over more territory. So they look like they're willing to push down towards Mandalay and Naypyidaw, but it isn't clear if they would push further to Yangon. Mm-hmm. Northern Shan state, there you have the Three Brothers Alliance.
Yep.
And principally the Myanmar National Democratic Alliance Army and the Ta'ang National Liberation Army. And they're currently, interesting, during June, which in July are making major advances. They want to create autonomous regions for their ethnic people. So skipping very quickly, the Karenni, same sort of thing. Get a Karenni state and they're happy. And the Karen, similar type thing, form a Karenni state. That's actually been the KNU, the Karen National Union's goal, even before the Union of Burma was formed in 1948. They thought the British had promised them that. Right. So what I'm describing is, and the Mon have actually recently come out and said, you know, we're going to form a Mon state. So it's not clear after they liberate what they consider their homelands, whether the EAOs are going to bother with the predominantly Bamar region or leave that for the Bamar to sort out. Right. And they'll just set up their autonomous states where they are.
And that's possibly one angle where Aung San Suu Kyi could emerge back into the picture as perhaps a negotiating force for Burma. Is that...
Correct. And right. If in that process she were somehow to emerge from detention, mm-hmm. put it that way right now, she might be able to rally the Baba at this stage and do what she didn't do during the time that she had an official position, which is to state counselor, which is to actually, in good faith, negotiate with the various major ethnic groups about some sort of federal republic where there would be equity among the various ethnic groups. Right. She didn't do that as state counselor, which was a major issue and problem. She seemed to be more focused on the power struggle she was having with the military.
Okay. With the ethnic states, how viable would they be as an ethnic state? One cannot imagine that some of the smaller ones, would they be capable of building an international airport? Would they be capable of joining ASEAN? Do you know what I mean? How viable would they be? I mean, we watched East Timor struggle to become a proper, fully fledged nation over the last 20 years, and it seems to be getting there. But for all these states within Burma, how realistic is independence as an option?
Well, it's not clear at this point, when I say autonomous state, whether their goal or objective would be full independence. Each of them has at some time indicated a willingness or interest in being part of a larger republic again. But the question is, how would that republic be formed? How would it be organized? Mm-hmm. The 2008 constitution or some revision of that, the EAOs are very clear. That's not on the table. That is not an option. We can't tweak the military junta's constitution and make it work. We need something very, very different.
Right.
So what I think is a high likelihood scenario is that each of these new ethnic states will focus on forming their own state government for a period of time, leaving ambiguous their larger relationship, and try to get that state apparatus up and running in cases where they haven't had it in the past. Mm-hmm. And then, if possible, gather with each other and talk about, okay, if we're going to form a republic, we're going to form a republic of actual states that are willing to be part of a larger federal republic. That never happened in Burma.
Right.
In the United States, we did that. You know, we had the 13 colonies, and the 13 colonies got together and said, okay, here's how we're going to divide power between the federal government and the states that we were forming.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one model for doing it. Other countries have done it in other ways. But what's interesting in Myanmar is they, virtually none of the ethnic states have ever had a state independent of the central government,
right.
At least certainly not since 48, and arguably under the British as well. They had these state areas, but it was basically the British dictating how you're going to be run. So this is a new area for them to form a republic in a, one could argue, sort of a more standard traditional fashion.
Right.
And I think that could be done.
Yep.
What's interesting is the last time I was in country, well, actually it was in India, but in Thailand, I was talking to some of the EAOs, and they were talking about, well, maybe we'll form a croissant country.
Oh,
well, in other words, this.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting they came up with croissant, but
yeah.
The idea is you would have the seven ethnic states around the Burma central land that would form a republic, and then they would then turn to Burma and say, do you want to be part of this?
Right. They'd have no option.
Which is, and that's, to go back to something you brought up earlier, the NUG. The NUG has been sort of pushing forward this idea of, oh, we have legitimacy and we are the national unity government. We are going to be the transitional interim government so that these negotiations can be held. And my understanding right now is that virtually none of the EAOs buy that model. They see the NUG as a fellow resistance force,
mm-hmm.
that have a number of PDFs in the Burma homeland that they're supplying and supporting. But the notion that they accept the unity charter, and that's like the 2008 constitution among the EAOs. Yeah, the unity charter, that, no, we don't. That's got to be renegotiated as well.
Yeah,
and that's one of the issues.
Right.
That's
the NUG seems to have this thinking that the war will be won and the pre-coup order will be restored. And that's just not going to happen from everything I've been hearing.
No, I agree with you. I don't think that's likely to happen. It would be a low likelihood. I'm an economist, so we never say no, we just say low likelihood.
Right.
But also the other issue is that I'm finding interesting is the intergenerational differences of opinion.
Right. Yeah.
So, and even among the EAOs, you're seeing the older EAO leaders who have in many cases been for decades fighting from the jungles or understanding that they should have, there's a presumption that they'll have some power or some authority or should be granted such after the victory is won. But you're seeing younger people, particularly in the PDFs, who are saying, wait a minute, we're the ones out there actually fighting, dying, or getting wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to also have a seat at the table to talk about what's going to come later. And hearing about in this intergenerational tension that's coming up. And some of those younger people are much more radical, I'll use that term, in their thinking. And so you hear among some of the younger PDF leaders, for example, that, well, maybe we just want to be a independent country. And in the capacity that I continue to function, I go, okay, well, you know, that's certainly an option, but let's think about some of the implications of it. You know, you're going to be a rather small country with a rather small population and perhaps lacking a sufficient international airport or a port through which you can readily ship things.
Trade.
How viable economically do you think, trade and other things, how economically viable do you think you will be as an independent country? And they'll pause and they'll go like, okay, that's a good point. And they'll think about it some more, but it's clear that, to me at least,
Yep.
among many of these ethnic, or the PDFs, the ethnic PDFs. They are much wider in their thinking about what a victorious resistance movement, what kind of country it would create, more so than the EAO leaders who either have their agenda from 50, 60 years ago that they're putting forward, or are still working very much in the mindset of a resistance force against a very powerful military.
I have heard similar stories from the foot soldiers in the PDFs and the EAOs, and they have zero tolerance for the idea that the military, the Barman military, should have any future role to play whatsoever going forward. And it's a very big mind shift which didn't exist before. And you know, 30% of the PDFs, EAOs are women, and they're young women in their 30s, and they're bringing what they think to the table as well. And it's really quite a movement. You get up to Maysot and the border towns, the artwork, the concept of revolution, the work that, you know, if they're not on the front line, they're delivering rice and food and running it across the border, or they're being sponsored in the Letway, the kickboxing tournaments in Bangkok, where they're you know, they're fighting. The options are you can fight, and if you win, you go to the next round, and if you don't win, you go back to the front line. So there's some incentives in there. Also, look, as you know, Daniel Crittenbrink, State Department second in command for East Asia, he was in Hanoi in June. He is a former U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, so he is obviously very well connected. But he met with a naval commander from Myanmar, and that really set tongues a-wagging in diplomatic corners across the region. Well, what's your take on the visit, and any ideas what they may or may not have discussed?
Well, much of it, that would be speculation. And as you pointed out, Ambassador Crittenbrink has a long relationship in the region. So he may have just simply been there for sort of an ASEAN-related event. And there was a Myanmar official who, or a junta official, who he met, with whom he met. That could be just diplomatic politeness. However, there's also the possibility, and here I am working off of limited information, that he was exploring the possibility that the military, under what conditions would the junta step aside? And I say that because since the coup, when you look at the statements coming out of the Biden administration and the State Department, there's still this notion of maybe we can negotiate a ceasefire, maybe we can negotiate some sort of transitional process to end the conflict, to end the fighting, and get the country back on the path towards a uneven transition towards democracy, which was, for the latter Obama years and through the woefully led Trump administration, and then into the Biden administration, at least with respect to Myanmar, there was sort of continuity of policy, which is this theme of it's undergoing this uneven one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. Transition is some form of democracy.
Right.
I never thought that was true myself, even when I was with CRS and I couldn't directly express my opinion that way.
Yep.
Now I can. I never thought that was true, but I feel like even to this day, there is within the State Department and within the Biden administration voices that are trying to get the country back on that fictitious path towards that it was on, towards the transition towards democracy. So he may have been trying to find out whether the junta would be open to a ceasefire and what the terms might be, or even further, some sort of, you know, all of you can pack up your things and your families and some of your wealth and move to a suitably friendly location where you can retire.
I have heard that Hun Sen in Cambodia had offered On Min Hlaing, the Hunter's chief. I don't know if sanctuary would be the appropriate word, but they have gotten along quite well over the last couple of years, and that I've been told that there is an option in there for a way out.
And there may come a time where such an international effort, whether it's led by the United States, the UN special representative, or whomever, for that to occur. I don't think that time's right now. And in particular, even if within the military junta there were some interest in such a situation, going back to what we were talking before, I don't see the EAOs and particularly the PDFs accepting any such deal. Because in addition to the strong opinions that you hear among the PDF representatives and leaders, one of the things that's very consistently coming through is they want accountability for the military leader. So the idea that they can go off to exile or, get some sort of amnesty and live a comfortable life in Phnom Penh, I don't see a lot of the EAOs and PDF saying, "Oh yeah, that's a deal we'll accept," at this point.
At the end of the day, it kind of appears heading in one direction only, which, with two possible solutions, either a negotiated way out or a complete slaughter. Now, well, I'm probably pushing it a little bit too far, but I wanted to ask you next, in the back of their minds, the junta generals, is it possible that they've accepted what everybody else is saying as fact? That they can't win this, that there's no way they can retake the territory they've lost over the last 6 months. There's just doesn't seem to appear a way out unless they are prepared to negotiate for them.
And that's the, if there's one area where the junta, the military in general, has demonstrated some skill, because militarily they haven't demonstrated a lot of skill.
Yeah, that's true.
Many people point out, you have all these resources, you have more than enough, you have a large number of troops, supposedly, and yet for 70 years you can't beat these relatively ragtag, and I don't want to mean
No,
the EAOs,
yep.
but relatively ragtag guerrilla groups. And so what have they done over the years? Their historic pattern is when the military tide turns against them, they offer a temporary ceasefire. They go out and they say, "Okay, well, what can we do to get you to stop killing us?" Effectively.
That's one way of putting
And
it. Yep.
and that's kind of glib, but that is sort of the pattern. And so, will they, for example, when they see that Mandalay's and Naypyidaw are encircled and under grave threat, and that, hypothetically speaking, the Arakan army goes like, "Well, now that we've got Rakhine, what more can we take?" And they start moving into Magway and other areas of the country, or throw their troops over into Shan State and help out their allies in the Three Brotherhood alliances. So if they feel under sufficient pressure, will they say, "Okay, how about this? We'll hold on to what's left of the seven divisions and the old capital city, both of them, and you accept that we control this, and we will give you all autonomy," since I'm making up scenarios,
No, I understand
"at
where
the
you're
level
going
that
on this,
the yeah that we gave to the United Wa State Army, which effectively runs as an independent country." And they go like, "Okay, we can do that
but
for
the
now."
EAOs are going to say, we already have that, and by the way, we'll have Yangon as well. It's
Yes.
it's kind of an hysterical scenario in that nobody through the system on all sides of the politics involved with this has wanted to negotiate with the NUG or the EAOs and the PDFs since the war erupted, which was about 3 months after the coup, call it. And now people are saying maybe we should. ASEAN didn't want to talk to them. They made glib efforts like We spoke with Lang, we spoke with the generals. Journalist question, did you speak with the EAOs? Oh, that'll happen later. We tried. Ong said, yeah, we know she's in prison. All these very awkward questions. Now they're sort of like, well, maybe we should. But why should the EAOs? Why should the PDFs and even the NUG talk with these people anymore? Because they have the upper hand and they were ignored for so long.
So it's interesting because take the NUG, at least here in the States, they are constantly or regularly in communication with officials from the Biden administration. And the Biden administration is comfortable with talking to the NUG. Okay. There's some sort of authenticity to the NUG that they're willing to have these open and frank discussions with them, although they're not ready to recognize them as a legitimate government in exile. So it's not gone that far, but there is a line. But in conversations I've had with officials in the Biden administration, you still have this reluctance to openly and frankly talk about their communications with the EAOs. Okay. They're going on. They have private, quiet meetings with EAO leadership. And there are many reasons why this open and frank discussions with the AAOs could be potentially problematic, diplomatic formalism, other, relations with ASEAN, the overarching thinking of the Biden administration about policy. I can speculate, but that's neither here nor there. But to me, it's kind of hard to not accept the reality of there is no functioning central government anymore in the country. We are looking at a situation like we see in many other countries around the world. We can click through some of them. I'll skip that. Where when you don't have a functioning central government, you talk to all the parties in the conflict openly to see where you can go from there. So I have been pushing, and you're getting some flexibility, but it seems difficult to get the flexibility to, for example, go meet with the KNU openly and say, hey, now that you are gaining more and more control of territory in the Karen homeland, do you need some assistance in setting up your government structure? What kind of technical support can we provide? What resources might you need so that you can form a viable Karen government that may down the road choose to be part of a Federal Republic of Burma or Myanmar or whatever name they wish to choose? A little bit surprised, but not totally surprised, but certainly personally frustrated by the seeming resistance to such a path towards a transition in the country. It still seems to be like, oh, we're going to get all the parties together and they're going to hold hands and agree that we're going to go back to something like the 2008 model and the old way of forming the republic. But I think that ship has sailed. That's not something particularly the younger generation or, as you point out, the women want. That's just...
It's not a,
not an option.
Yeah. Look, thanks, Michael. This has been terrific. I've just got one last question. In regards to November's election, Joe Biden, a re-election would seem to mean that the current quiet backdoor negotiations that are going on would continue, one would assume. But if Donald Trump was elected, what would that mean in regards to the civil conflict in Myanmar?
Well, setting aside the implications for the United States and our democracy in general.
Yes.
Which, particularly this past week...
it's been extraordinary.
Just unfathomable. No, I don't mind about saying this. What has happened, it's discouraging for many of us. But setting that aside, with respect to specifically on Myanmar, if you had the re-election of Joe Biden, I think you're going to see a continuation of where they've been moving And my optimism would say a growing realization of how the political situation in Myanmar has changed. And so a move towards what I think are more sensible policies than where they are right now. Not that the Biden administration policies are bad right now, but they could be better. There's room for improvement. A second Trump administration, it's really hard to tell what would come out of that. My tongue-in-cheek comment that I make, and I don't mean it literally, but I questioned whether in starting with the White House and moving all the way down to the secretaries of state that Trump had, if anybody could find Myanmar on a globe or on a map. They just seem to have no understanding or recognition of what was going on there. There were people in the State Department who were in positions of authority who did have some ideas about what could be done. And I think to a certain extent, lacking guidance from above, they were quietly keeping things along the path that they were before. But Trump is so capricious and unsteady in his thinking, he could do just about anything with respect to it. I doubt he would throw his support behind the military junta, but he has shown a proclivity of liking autocratic leaders. So it's just really, really hard to say what happened to the Trump administration. For those who, like myself, would like to see a democratic government emerge in what has been Myanmar, or more than one government, I don't need for it to stay a unified country. But for the people there to have the right of self-determination to form the government of the style of their choosing, I'd prefer it be democratic. I'd prefer that it respect the international human rights of all the people who live in their countries. But beyond that, it's up to them. But if that's what you want and you're pushing for that, if you live in the United States and you're a citizen, that would be a reason to vote for Joe Biden, not or the Democratic candidate, and not vote for Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump makes it totally uncertain what will happen with respect to that country.
Right, and I guess it's fingers crossed for Myanmar's future and the American elections in November. Michael Martin, good luck and thank you very much. It's been a terrific chat, and hopefully we can do another podcast on the region over the months coming forward.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting me, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
It was good fun. Thanks, Mike.